It's a very great honour to have been given these awards. The Association for Computing Machinery's Athena Award, sponsored by the ACM Women's Committee, having been nominated by the ACM Special Interest Group on Information Retrieval, and the British Computer Society's Lovelace Medal. I would like to say how much I appreciate this recognition. Thank you, ACM and BCS. I would particularly like to say, and I hope the ACM will not take this amiss, how I appreciate being the first woman to be awarded the BCS Lovelace Medal. The awards carry the opportunity to give a lecture with them. I deeply regret not being able to do this live and in a way to suit each case specifically. But I hope this single video talk will go a little way as a substitute for two proper lectures. My title is Natural Language and the Information Layer. My talk has three parts. On the first phase of natural language processing research and its lessons, on subsequent developments up to the present and their lessons, and where we are now and what I think are the wider implications for the future. Part one, words, classification and retrieval. When I began researching computing nearly 50 years ago, people were very excited about what could be done with computers, challenged by how to do it, and pushing applications that offered new opportunities in dealing with information. One of these areas was natural language processing, NLP, or natural language information processing, that is to say, processing information conveyed in natural language, which I'm going to call NLIP. At that time, most researchers thought primarily of the efficiency gains that could be made by emulating or supporting people, for example, in translation or document retrieval. Though earlier visionaries, like Warren Weaver, had seen how computers could open up quite novel possibilities, and a little later, Doug Engelbart would illustrate some of these possibilities. My own research focused on automatic classification, nowadays called unsupervised machine learning. It's clear that humans rely in NLP on the or NLIP on the use of general conceptual classifications of words, like a thesaurus, with which you're all familiar, to resolve ambiguity in language, and by language here I mainly mean in practice, text. In practice, of computational work. Individual words are ambiguous, and so are the structures represented by word strings. These ambiguities are resolved by the fact that discourse is coherent and effective because concepts and topics are repeated, and repeated enough to get them across. Repeated individual concepts and standard conceptual patterns enable us to select the right meanings for words and for structural relationships for word sequences. This very general idea fairly obviously applies to translation, but it also applies to document retrieval. Different words in a query and a document may still stand for the same concept and thus be allowed to match. The question is where to get the lexical classification and stock of text patterns from. The obvious answer is from texts. If words tend to occur in many texts, this similar behaviour suggests that they are conceptually related. Thus, in principle, one should be able to build a thesaurus from a vast text corpus. Analogously, use a large text corpus to extract repeating conceptual patterns. I was interested in building a thesaurus for translation, but of course, at that time had no corpus. I managed to finesse this by exploiting some limited dictionary, not thesaurus, data for a pilot demonstration. I showed that you could build a thesaurus and you could, this was of course by hand simulation, use such a semantic classification to select the correct senses of words. For retrieval, rather than translation, the situation is easier. The collection of documents or texts from which you want to retrieve supplies the corpus to build the classification. And that strategy is what we did, we adopted, with some success in retrieval. In other words, we built a classification from the words in the documents, in the collection of documents that we wanted to retrieve from. And we built it sufficiently well to get some success in retrieving wanted documents. That success, however, came not just from classification, but particularly when in the classification, we took relative word frequency into account and factored it in an appropriate way. And indeed, eventually, we got more success by capturing word frequency, not just in a crude way, frequent, non-frequent, but by capturing it in word weighting. Documents score not just by the number of words that match, but by the sum of their weights, which are based on frequency. Now, all of this was essentially statistical in character. Facts about word occurrences and co-occurrences were used to capture meaning in a way that could be manipulated without needing to know what that meaning was. An unusually frequent word in a document is a good indicator of an important topic in the document. So if the query uses the word, the document is likely to be relevant to your information need. One very simple word weighting formula captures this effectively. If a word occurs in many documents, most of these, other things being equal, are unlikely to be relevant to the user's information need. Weighting by inverse document frequency relatively favors less common and more discriminating terms. If you also take account of within document frequency, so-called term frequency, TF, and also manipulate by document length, modulate by document length as appropriate, especially for full text, you get a robust, easily implemented mechanism, so-called TF times IDF time type weighting. And this has consistently performed well. If, in addition, you can find out that some documents are relevant to the user's need, as you might in an interactive or relevance feedback environment, you can distinguish between query term occurrences in relevant and in non-relevant documents and do a much more discriminating and hence effective retrieval job, still very simply using the same basic formula but with this distinction between relevant and non-relevant included. All of this was established through exhaustive experiments supported by theory development by the mid-1970s. But quite apart from being ignored by conventional library and abstract services, it wasn't thought of as having anything to do with computing proper, which was all about fundamental, generic things like programming languages and compilers and operating systems, and which, as computing developed further, again, was thought of as fundamentally and generically with, on the one hand, having motivating and validating theory, say using Scott Strachey semantics on the one hand, and by incorporating notions associated with distributed systems and security on the other. In other words, these things like programming languages, compilers, operating systems, theory supported and extended to distributed systems and security were what real computing was about. But I think even then, the retrieval research, although nobody took much notice of it, did contain an important lesson. This was not a novel lesson in itself, but it's one that's important, though too often forgotten, when you try to get computers to do things the humans do. Thus, particularly in the early days of automatic classification work, nobody really examined the assumptions on which it was based. That is to say, what a classification should be like and what it was for. It's easy to believe there are natural classes in a universe of objects being classified. And because there are natural classifications, these will be appropriate for whatever you want to use them for. The only challenge in automation is how to find these natural classes. But in fact, this isn't true even in biology, any more than it is true in retrieval, as indeed retrieval researchers found. There are lots of ways, equally plausible, to group things, even given the same feature descriptions. And the issue is to analyze the purpose for which classification is intended and to develop one, to develop a classification to suit that purpose. In retrieval, you want to achieve precision, getting only relevant documents, and recall all the relevant documents. In fact, these two goals are conflicting. In the early work on automatic classification, it turned out, contrary to expectation, that precision promoting tight classes, not recall promoting hospitable ones, were what was actually required. The effectiveness of weighting was geared to this same truth. IDF weighting is not an obvious notion. But in fact, words are sloppy. So if you don't constrain word matching, things will get just too sloppy. Learning all of this, what you want to achieve by automation, being not what you think you want to achieve by automating human beliefs and actions, took much trial and error, and demonstrated the need for fresh thinking about goals, for thorough experiment, and for a sound evaluation methodology. So the lesson from phase one in retrieval was, you're not necessarily trying to do what you thought originally you were trying to do. You've got to figure it out what it is you really want to do. And then when you've done that, at least in retrieval, statistics turns out to be a good thing. Part two, which I've called Symbols, the World, and Language Interpretation. Now, indexing and retrieval, thus statistically characterized as I have done, are towards one end of the spectrum of NLIP tasks. Translation or question answering or summarizing appear to require symbolic processing, that is to say, syntactic parsing and semantic analysis and interpretation, and manipulation, the manipulation of an explicit meaning representation, and of course, complementarily for generating. By symbolic, I mean displaying the meaning of a simple sentence like "the girl ate chocolates" as a young female, as agent, taking into herself in the past some sweet consumables as objects, with every component of this representation, this meaning representation, actually being a formal, well-defined symbol for something in some world. The belief that you needed symbolic processing is illustrated by such a case as correctly answering such a question as, did John marry the girl he loved, will not necessarily be correctly answered by just matching on the words John, Mary, girl, loved. Similarly, it's hard to see how summarizing the mini text, Mary went into the garden and cut some roses and lilies. She arranged them all in a tall, dark brown jug. As Mary did a vase of flowers. That is to say, it's hard to see how you could do summarizing, as I've just illustrated it, by some simple statistical word-based operation. Such a procedure would not deal with referring expressions like them, or, as I've illustrated it, the greater importance of jug than brown. So something much more complex is going on in generating even that very, very elementary little summary from that longer source text. While research on retrieval was slowly building up, people in the NLP community from the 1970s onwards through the 80s and into the 90s were developing the tools for symbolic processing, parsers, lexicons, representation formalisms, and inference mechanisms that encouraged them to tackle challenging NLP tasks, NLIP tasks that seemed to require symbolic language processing, to build and use deep sentence and text meaning representations, and to relate them to the world models. For example, given Jill fell off her horse, what do you have to do to answer the question, did it run away? That seems to require some connectivity with models of the behavior of horses in the real world when their riders appear to do strange things. Doing this kind of thing turned out to be hard, harder than expected even for apparently elementary tasks like simple natural language query to databases. There was also a growing problem about evaluation. In principle, one can build a system, deploy it for real, and see whether it works satisfactorily. But as this is very expensive, you would like some means of earlier evaluation. Unfortunately, it's extremely difficult to say exactly what a system ought to deliver in the fine grain, especially when you're trying to do something new and not just to replicate an old, manually obtained output. And of course, looking at system internal products like a meaning representation is of very limited value in terms of the ultimate task you're trying to achieve. In this context, it's important to note that there is no absolute rightness about manual products. The idea that humans will always deliver the best summary of a source text is a mistake. It's not the case either that humans will always, say professional searchers, will always deliver the best set of candidate documents for the user. So even if you could, in principle, replicate humans, it's not clear that that would give you, in a more absolute sense, the best performance. So, for example, if you think about the implications of what I've just said, take information or fact extraction from text. What fact should we be trying to obtain from a little text like, Peter patted the dog and stroked the big black cat? I'm sorry about these very simple examples, but I'm deliberately keeping them simple to show that even the most basic and elementary uses of language present quite striking problems. So, given Peter patted the dog and stroked the big black cat, do we just want to extract some little facts? Peter patted a dog, Peter stroked a cat. Or do we want to extract Peter patted a dog at time T1, Peter stroked a cat at time T2? Now notice, the original text didn't have mentioned any specific times. Saying that these two events occurred in that particular order, one after the other, is an inference. Do I want to extract something as primitive as, there was a dog, there was a cat, and so forth, and then Peter patted the dog and so on? Do I want to bother to extract, a cat was big, a cat was black? How do I signal that they are the same cat? In fact, there's no limit to what you can inferentially extract if you put your mind to it, as I hope these examples illustrate. But do you want it all? How do you express it? What is a primitive fact, let's say? And how do you assess whether the facts that you've extracted will be useful for some future purpose for which the collection of facts you extracted is actually required? Retrieval research avoided this problem by taking user relevance assessments for their queries as gold standard. But relevance is a broad notion, and the retrieved documents are only vehicles for the user's information discovery process. In other words, one can do quite well by having a gold standard like that, because the aim of the objective is still rather hospitable. You're giving documents to a user for them to interpret and do things with. With fact extraction for a large information base or summarization, the situation is more complex. Facts are specific nuggets, and summaries are new but information-losing discourses in their own right. So it is impossible to say whether a user's interest, for example, tell me about Peter, is only or best satisfied by one system output rather than another. It's quite possible that several would be equally satisfactory, and none of them might be very satisfactory. The underlying problem is that tasks like information extraction or summarizing or translation are not in fact unitary tasks. Retrieval when you look at it, isn't either, but it has a modest aim, just to offer the user something they may be able to make something of in pretty well any context. Summarizing, on the other hand, as an example, is a very complex task with much more potential variation and therefore more need to be designed for different types of situation. As an example, Google's little snippet summaries are useful for some purposes, but they're absolutely useless for others. They don't tell you, for example, what the document as a whole is about and what's most important in that document. What NLRP research, especially since the early 1990s, has shown in attempting to build and evaluate systems for such challenging tasks as summarizing, is that these tasks come in many shapes and that there are consequently many different appropriate strategies for doing them to suit circumstances. More importantly, it became evident that these tasks in their simpler forms can be done with statistical techniques or hybrid statistical symbolic approaches of a relatively shallow rather than the deep kind. In other words, you make a not very resolved or decomposed meaning representation. You can indeed do translation or fact extraction or summarizing purely statistically, quite well enough to meet some needs, and even apply these techniques cross-linguistically. For example, for summarizing, you can learn word selection and word order for the output summary from example source and summary pairs, at least in the case of telegraphic one-line summaries. And since such processes rely on training data, this isn't a problem because we now have plenty of training data for such things. Statistical data is also a vital support for symbolic processing when this is needed. For example, about normal parsing preferences. If you're going to have to do syntactic parsing, it's helpful, given there are very, very many alternative parsing opportunities, to have some guidance as to which, in the absence of any countervailing information, is likely to be the most likely one. So the lesson we learnt from the second phase of NLIP is that statistics can be more useful in more ways than might have been seen possible in the early days of NLIP, when statistics, even for a humdrum task like retrieval, was quite a revolutionary notion. Now, in fact, TF, IDF, and so forth are embedded in web search engines. And as a parenthesis there, I might note how long it took for those research ideas to actually reach commercial application. People didn't want to pick them up on the one hand, and on the other hand, the opportunities in terms of large volumes of material to search were not actually there. Machine learning also is the default base for speech transcription, and largely statistical extractive techniques, choosing sentences with a high concentration of statistically good words, can provide useful automatic summaries, even if, to meet higher quality needs, all the full symbolic apparatus of meaning representation, world models, and inference is essential. So the lesson from phase two is that you can do a lot more with statistics in NLIP than you thought. This has been a very striking but also solid development of the last couple of decades in particular. So now my third part, which I've called language and information. What then, given what I've said about the first two phases and where we are now, what do the key features of the present state of NLIP suggest for the future? And in particular, what do they suggest for computing in general, not just NLIP itself? I'm going to assume here, in fact, that NLIP research will go from strength to strength in more or less, but of course not completely, predictable developments for some time from the present state of affairs. I want to focus on the implications for computing in general here. Now, the key feature of the present state of research in the NLIP field is the way that NLIP is seamless. It's seamless both because different tasks or component functions, like answering a single question, merge into one another. And it's also seamless because basic processes, especially statistical ones like estimating relative word significance, apply across the field. Now, from one point of view, this seamlessness is not surprising, given that we're dealing with natural language. And natural language, despite its huge range of specific capabilities and varied uses, is the common vehicle for our communication. And in this, it always has to deal with constituent ambiguity. Dealing with ambiguity applies across whatever particular situation you're using the language in. The seamlessness in the utility of statistics, like applying Bayes' theorem, does seem more surprising. But again, that's not so. Given that we have to cope with ambiguity, we as humans have to cope with ambiguity quickly in real time, and so need robust and simple methods for doing this. Relying on frequency, of course, in reality, we do this by approximation, not by actual calculations. But exploiting frequency is such a robust and simple method for helping you along. Thus, even if you can't rely only on such methods in NLIP, the important point about the experience of the last 50 years, first in retrieval, then in other NLIP tasks, is that you can get a lot of mileage in, as it were, finding your feet by exploiting rough and simple processes, either on their own or to leverage a more sophisticated one. For example, suggest a likely preferred path to pursue in full text interpretation. I believe that the consequences of this for computing in general, not just NLIP, are profound. They have to do with the notion of information layer. This is not a well-defined notion, but that doesn't make it any less real or important. It's also been around for some time. What I want to suggest now is that with the experience of NLIP, we can give it more substance. Early on, and putting it very simplistically, the model of computing was that it consisted of a hardware layer at the bottom, then an operating system layer, then maybe a utilities layer, with a final applications layer on top. By applications here, I mean something like an accounting package. This simple model was first developed to accommodate distributed systems and communications, introducing what I'm calling a communications layer between hardware and soft operating system. It then appeared, as systems grew more powerful, that it could be appropriate to think of an information layer. Not just a bits layer, or a data layer in some conventional sense, i.e. a well-defined tuples or packages of bits constituting nuggets or something, as part of the computing system proper, and not just, as in the old library days, an application. The natural place for the information layer was on top of the operating system, or at least utilities layer. The information layer could indeed perhaps absorb the utilities layer in a closer relationship with the operating system. Now, in this sort of rather amorphous but emergent view, the crucial point about it was that the information layer would have widely useful substantive content, something rather different from the familiar but formal notion of data as something systems ship about. The information layer would contain things that you could get at, not just that you were moving. Now, you might say that this is what we've been getting with web browsers and, especially, all-pervading web engines. But this is only half right if one thinks of browser or search functionality. That's to say, you think of browsing and searching only from the operational or functional point of view. What really matters is the stuff that the browsers and search engines work over. The stuff, that's to say, incipient information. And my claim is that what matters about the idea of information layer is the stuff itself. This is what's making the information layer important, not just a particular functionality. Now, this argument that the information layer is a stuff layer seems to fly in the face of computing as essentially syntactic manipulation of opaque coded objects. So my argument is as follows. People don't talk in numbers, they talk in language. Wherever end users appear, which is everywhere, they need a familiar communication vehicle for information, and natural language is what they use. Unfortunately, they still have to interpret language to decide what the information is and how to use it. But they know how to do that, and if they can be materially assisted by automatic processes like, in the simple case, text retrieval, that's very valuable, and also, of course, by other facilities like translation or summarising. Now, one might argue this isn't logically any different from the conventional coded account of computing. But I claim that the code and what's coded are far nearer and more accessible to humans in the information case where we're dealing with language. Words are there for themselves, that's to say, as their familiar selves, and have not been replaced by other codes. We have at the same time to recognize and allow for the fact that every language use in a context is different. So there will be an early limit to how resolved and explicit the language processing and what it manipulates will actually be like. The idea of a semantic, and I'm sticking my neck out a little here, the idea of a semantic web as a universal characterization knowledge strikes me as misconceived. There can be no ontology that will work for everything and everyone. There may be many specific ontological horses for particular courses. But the universal means for getting from one to another cannot but be a sort of lightweight ropeway. Something like that, modest and partial though it may be, does establish links and make it possible to move around. This is what natural language tools like statistical associations between words provide. People can get a start and move from simple words or phrases and connective relations between them. Natural language is general, but it leads to particulars. But it's not quite clear why such an information layer, as I've indicated it, incorporating the vast language stuff that exists electronically, but with an eye on the user, should be a middle rather than an outer layer in computing systems. My point, and I feel very nervous here about something that is actually rather sketchy, and but in the sense, because I'm looking to the future, unavoidably vague. My point here is that there is no reason to suppose that what are semantic operations, if only shallow ones, on the layer, are only for the immediate benefit of the end user. There is no reason to suppose that as computing systems become more powerful and pervasive, they will not find it convenient, even necessary, to do the same sort of thing themselves. For example, while system security ought to be as tight as a drum with formal coding, in reality it won't be watertight, and it may be desirable for the system to see how it can be helped by whatever information it can dig out of the information layer. For example, and as I say, this is only very sketchy and indicative, also in this particular example, because I'm not a security expert, for example, it may be possible to learn more and hence plug system gaps in some supposedly secure situation by trawling the information layer for correlates of the words that figure somewhere in the security setup. Whether these words have to do with the agents involved, the wrapping of the package, or the contents of the package. I recognize that this is very vague. That's not surprising, as I've already suggested, because I'm talking about a future possibility. But I think that people are getting overexcited about images and forgetting the crucial role that language has. You can look at pictures, but you have to use language to talk about them. So I believe we have a wonderfully rich resource in all the words, the stuff of information, that are becoming available, and that we should think imaginatively about what it could be like for computing systems not only to make this stuff available to end users, but to exploit it for themselves. I see that as an exciting opportunity. Finally, in conclusion, I would not only like to thank you all again, but I would also like to thank my husband, the late Roger Needham, who always encouraged my work.